respected law enforcement leaders for public health and human rights. I think I caught the cameraman on the hop there. My name is Tom Lloyd. I was a policeman for more than 30 years in the United Kingdom and retired as a chief constable, a chief of police, about 5 years ago. And since then, I've been involved in drug policy reform work, and in particular, more recently, engaging with the police in what they can do to bring about drug policy reform and reduce harms and ensure that human rights are protected. Now, let me introduce the panelists. On my far left, Datuk Zaman, a very distinguished man who served the Malaysian police force for 35 years. And during his years of service, he held several key positions. He was Commissioner of Police, Director of Criminal Investigation, and the Director General of the Prisons Department. In May of this year, having served as Vice President, he was elected as the President of the Malaysian AIDS Council for the term 2010-2012. And as I haven't seen you since then, congratulations. He also graduated from the Royal College of Defence Studies in United Kingdom, and that's a very, very distinguished item on his curriculum vitae. And he also holds a graduate certificate in management from the Monash Mantelisa Business School. To my left is Geoffrey Monaghan. He's the regional drug and HIV/AIDS expert with the United Nations Office and Drugs and Crime Office for Russia. And he's lived and worked in Moscow since 2005. Prior to that, he served as a detective sergeant in the Metropolitan Police Service, New Scotland Yard in London, and he was a specialist in drug policy and drug enforcement strategy. I think you probably still are, even though not a serving police officer. And he was a member of the Justice Committee of Experts on Drugs and the Law in 1991. Justice is the British section of the International Commission of Jurists, and he's a staff officer and was a staff officer to the Association of Chief Police Officers Drug Subcommittee. So he's got a really in-depth knowledge of UK drug policy and policing. And he's now a member of the editorial board of Substance Use and Misuse and an associate researcher with Semion Research Centre, Rome. To my right, delighted to welcome Alexander Zelichenko. He was born in 1957 in Kyrgyzstan. He's a police colonel, an academic researcher, as well as a member of the Journalists Association of Kyrgyzstan and of the National Writers Association of Kyrgyzstan. And he's just given me a book that he's written. So it's not, I'm not just describing somebody in the abstract. He's actually written something, so thank you. He was among the founders and first leader of the Special Drug Control Service under the Ministry of Internal Affairs and the State Commission on Drug Control under the government of the government of the Kyrgyzstan Republic. He was also chair of the Kyrgyzstan Organization of the International Association on Combating Against Drug Abusing and Narco Business. He's been a member of the United Nations and OSCE missions to the Balkan countries. He was a team leader of the International Police Instructors for the post-conflict area in South Serbia. And he's trained more than 700 police officers in crime prevention, anti-drug police activity, and community policing issues. He's the director of the Central Asian Centre on Drug Policy and the head of Department on Analysis, Strategic Planning and International Cooperation, Senior Department on Drug Control, Ministry of Interior, Kyrgyzstan. And you published numerous articles, essays, etc. I think just on the basis of the of what you've actually done, you kind of beat us all, I think.
Yeah.
Well, those are our three panelists. I'm delighted that we've got such a good audience to listen to what we hope to interest you with. Background clearly in law enforcement, and you may wonder why we're here at an AIDS, international AIDS conference. Well, to me, the link is extremely clear and compelling. That whether it's intentional or not, law enforcement contributes, sadly, contributes extensively to the spread of HIV/AIDS throughout the world. There are some examples where countries have adopted, for example, needle exchange programs, where the incidence of AIDS has not increased as it was once predicted in the 1980s. There are other countries where that hasn't happened, and we are tragically seeing a huge increase in HIV/AIDS. There are harms, in my view, that outweigh the benefits of our current approach to law enforcement. And my 30 years of policing in the United Kingdom, which in some ways is an enlightened country in terms of its approach to harm reduction, my experience is that our approach has been a failure. It's been very expensive, and it's been counterproductive, not just in terms of driving risky behavior by intravenous drug users, because the use of drugs is illegal, but also in convicting many people who, in my view, shouldn't have been convicted. And I'm responsible for some of those convictions, as I'm sure some of my colleagues will share with me, that perhaps we look back on that and think maybe this wasn't the best thing we could have done. But that's really at the core of this, that I believe that if human rights, if harm reduction is going to gain more purchase and deliver greater benefits, as we all want, we must engage with law enforcement. And I know that there's a big gap between the understanding of law enforcement officials, many law enforcement officials, about what it is right to do, compared to the understanding from people who work in support of drug users, who work in support of human rights, who work in support of harm reduction. I'm currently leading a project for the International Drug Policy Consortium. We call it the Law Enforcement Project. And the core of that project is the desire to bring law enforcement and other people working for human rights enhancement and harm reduction together to engage in a dialogue so that understanding increases and ultimately the behavior of law enforcement changes. The job of law enforcement is to serve and protect. It's not to oppress and abuse. But the system can drive that. I believe there are many police officers who don't want to do that. And it seems to me there's a real opportunity and a need for those engaged in the harm reduction and human rights business to look at police in slightly fresh eyes. And so you may be doing things with which we disagree, but we want to work alongside you so that we can start changing the way law enforcement operates. That's a core of what drives me and drives my work at the moment. Now, what I'd like to do is to ask the panelists just to speak briefly on a couple of topics, and they'll be talking from their own experience. But at the same time, I'm hoping that there are some cards, question cards, that will be passed around to you, because I am interested, after they've given their initial introduction, in hearing questions from you. If you put them on cards, they'll come to me, and then we can have a session so that some of your concerns and interests get reflected in the discussion. So that way, I think we'll get a much richer opportunity to hear what the panelists have to say. There are two key issues I want the panelists to address in the first instance, which is why law enforcement and, if you like, public health workers have this different understanding, this different perspective that prevents good collaborative working. And what can be done about that in a practical way so that law enforcement can actually be engaged in public health issues as part of the core business of policing, which is, as I said, I believe is to serve and protect people from coming to harm. So I invite Datuk Zaman in the first instance, just to give us some thoughts from your perspective in Malaysia about, you know, why we've got this problem and some of the practical issues that, that can be, you know, can be addressed.
Yes. As a policeman, I think I was very hard on the criminal, particularly the drug users. It's often that I used to...
Datuk, we need to make sure this microphone is turned up.
Is it working? Hello? Thank you.
Okay.
Well, as a policeman, I used to be very hard on the people who use drugs. The reason is, I think they contributed quite a figure for in our crime statistic. And the public wants you to take action. Of course, the public is not aware about the harm that we're going to cause by doing what we call in Malaysia trawling. Trawling fishing is, you know, when you use a trawl, you destroy, you catch everything on the ocean floor. And it's a waste. But when I went to the prison, not that I was convicted, I was sent there as a director general, I begin to realize that what we have done in the past is not right. It's not right, actually. These people need attention. They need rehabilitation. More than that, I think they need treatment and care, which is a human right. When I went to the prison, one of the first things I told my prison officers was, a prisoner only loses his freedom of right. He loses the right to freedom. He must remain within the sort of custodial perimeter. Other than that, he's entitled to proper treatment, proper food, proper rest, and proper respect. And I think when I saw the HIV people in the prison, I begin to realize that we need to help them. And I think this is the area where the police, law enforcement agencies actually, can play a role. Because the very thing they do by arresting and... I come from a country where there is zero tolerance for drugs. They say by 2015, Malaysia should be drug-free. I think I put in my note, I say my foot can never do that. The way to face this thing is, I think, for the law enforcement agencies to appreciate that these people, the police can play a role, a very important role in getting treatment and care to the people who are living with HIV/AIDS. But sad to say, even now, although we have introduced needle exchange for the past 3 years, and we have methadone for the past 5 years or so, we still have, we still continue to have harassment from the law enforcement. There are two main agencies there, actually, the anti-drug agency and the police force. But happily, of course, I've been told the new director general of the anti-drug agency has put the enforcement group in the cold storage and begin to take more on the treatment care. Well, I think I hope this will be a real reality. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Datuk. It's interesting there that what Datuk said at the beginning, and this is an issue for police that must be responsive to the community they serve, the whole community, is that the public demand harsh action against drug users, but they're also not aware of the harms that arise out of that. And the media are very happy to carry a story about, you know, a drug raid or something like that, but they tend not to link that raid and that enforcement with some of the harmful consequences. I'll turn now to Jeff, please, for again your thoughts on the same issue. Why we, you know, why we've got this problem, and some of the practical issues from your perspective that could be done to do, you know, could be done about it.
Well, I think a lot of the difficulties really are linked to performance indicators, police performance indicators, public expectations, as you've already alluded to, the political rhetoric, crackdown on drugs, vigorous enforcement policies, which sometimes obviously lose their way if they're ill-defined, not sufficiently articulated enough to be translated into more effective operational responses. Having said that, I think that there's a growing number of police officers, police services throughout the world who are ready to embrace a harm reduction approach. I think the trick is from there is how you actually embed harm reduction principles in policing practices. And do you, for example, stop arresting people in possession of small amounts of drugs
Yes.
But if you do that, do you then miss out on opportunities to uncover, detect other more serious offences? And we know from the research, we know from our own experiences that that is sometimes the case. And then how do you make that particular transition palatable to the public? Because if the public are left with the impression that police no longer care about minor drug offences, that they won't respond to groups of people, say, using heroin in public places or smoking crack cocaine in public places, this could also have an adverse effect on public police relations. So there is a difficulty there. But I think there's a lot of good practices now in a number of countries. And I would say the UK, Australia, some Canadian cities, some cities in America, elsewhere, where really it is possible to achieve this balance of, as I say, responding to the public needs, public expectations, and actually at the same time making sure that police activities, law enforcement activities, support rather than thwart public health ambitions. And as I say, there's a growing literature that shows that it is possible, it's doable.
Since you started off there talking about performance indicators, and I think that certainly the perspective of the UK, not just in policing, but actually in the health service and education, is that performance indicators haven't helped make progress, because often the indicators chosen are the ones that are relatively easy. And certainly in the drugs world, the drug enforcement world, police behaviour in arresting and seizing, arresting users, dealers, and in seizing drugs is reinforced by the fact that those are highly regarded performance indicators by political masters as well as by the public. And that drives the police down that route of enforcement without having concern for things like the number of deaths arising out of unnecessary overdoses, the number of deaths arising out of contracting blood-borne diseases, the rate of starting to take drugs, you know, trying to make that so that the initial entry to drugs starts to rise so that young people are better protected. And all of these are potential performance indicators. We're talking in a context of a law that is not really changing much at the moment. And I know that I think all three panellists would agree that there does need to be some quite radical law reform. But I just want to kind of remind us that this is more about trying to work with what we've got at the moment, whereas an ideal might be some quite substantial changes in both international and national legislation to give the police more room to manoeuvre. But, you know, bearing that in mind, we've got to work with what we've got and where we are. So I'd be very interested in your views on this topic, Alex.
Okay, well, first of all, I would like to mention police and public health are totally... We were created from different material and for different, absolutely different tasks. So that's why, for example, we are still using... I was educated in a former Soviet Union police school. But in my part of the world, we are still using the old system of police education. So that's why we are still talking to our cadets. The drug users are your enemy, they are enemy of the state, they are enemy of themselves, they are enemy of the family. As much as you can send them behind the bar, it's better for all of us, better for society. So we have to use this approach more than 70 years, former Soviet Union and during the independent time. So finally we recognize that about 40% of imprisonments, they were sent behind the bar just for the drugs connection crimes, 40%. In 2005, I did a rapid assessment in our prison. The prison population at that particular time was 16,000 imprisonments. So 40%, 4,000 more. More than 4,000 were in this place because they have to break the law connected with drugs issues. So we decided it's something wrong. If such a big amount of people broken the rules, broken the law, it means the law are not good, not the people. So, and the second thing, maybe it is interesting now, I'm just thinking now about that, the HIV issues became a base to cooperate us and to be a point which turn us to understand we need to cooperate. We need to cooperate with public health, first of all, and we need to cooperate with a society, social society around. So, first of all, I guess, and we prove in practice, we need to educate police. We need to tell them to change their behavior. This is not your enemy. For example, when I'm talking now with my cadets, with my police colleagues, I trying to explain them the reality. I started from, for example, from the roots of Afghan narco expansion. I am trying to explain them your enemy are not those poor drug users. He is a target of social workers or the public health. But for you, you need to fight with the sharks, with those who are doing business. That's why you are investigator. It's very easy to go to the street and to catch dozen of drug users. And you will be the best from the best police officer. But they are sick people, so don't do it. And police started to understand. When you explain them the connection between drugs and terrorism, drugs and organized crime, drugs and weapons, they started to understand something. So the police education in Kyrgyzstan, we have 15 years already. We started this police educational process since 1998. And we are still continuing. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed. It's interesting that how you emphasize the point that if the police are educated in a particular way, and we're talking here about perhaps predominantly young men, but young men and women who are learning about life and learning about society. And if the and I remember at training school, your police instructor is a form of God. You have to do what they say, and they will tell you that this is the way things work, and you want to conform within that organisation. And so it's not surprising that that happens. So it's very encouraging to hear that you're actually taking steps to, you know, to educate people to people differently. Well, I have got loads of questions, and I know I'm the moderator, but I'm glad that we've got a couple of questions from the audience, and I hope others are perhaps filling in the cards. Yes, so there are, good. But I've got one question here, which is from, I think, I can't read it, but Nana Oi from Ghana. I hope that's not, I hope that's nearly right. And really the point of your question is that the police service is structured, organised and conservative, and has to operate within laws, rules and regulations. So how can we actually ask the police or get the police to change without a change in the law? Perhaps I could ask Jeff just to address that first. You know, I mean, you've got to follow the law. It's interesting that Bill Clinton this morning, when he was president, didn't say, as he just said this morning, that we know what the answer is. It's harm reduction. And similarly, when I was a chief constable in office, I was very careful about what I said publicly. And I think people recognise that you have responsibilities to the law that's passed by a democratic government. It's really a question, what room for manoeuvre is there for the police within the constraints that exist?
I think there's a good deal of room. I mean, even in countries like Russia, which don't perhaps readily spring to mind in terms of flexible law enforcement policies or a good deal of imagination when it comes to harm reduction policies, I think there are plenty of examples where police officers use their discretion, choose not to arrest. Prosecutors choose not to prosecute. And this is something which we can actually exploit. And I can't say for sure that the situation pertains in every country in the world, but my experience, my travel experience, and the fact that I've got a significant network of former law enforcement officers and currently serving law enforcement officers in many different countries suggests that most countries do indeed have their basis of policing, whether it's in the form of constitutional articles, some degree of discretion. In other words, that there is really no piece of legislation which says that in every case a person must be arrested, in every case a person must be prosecuted. Often, as I say, these decisions are made on the back of political concerns, on the back of public outrages. So you don't necessarily have to go down the route of changing the law. In fact, I would suggest that that's probably a waste of time in many countries. Rather, the focus should be to try and encourage law enforcement officers to think about changing their performance indicators, to work more closely with NGOs, to form real viable partnerships with NGOs, and to actually encourage officers to take on board the fact that they do have a role to play in supporting public health policies and practices. Indeed, a very important role. And again, you can actually use the history. The history is with us on this point, because whilst HIV prevention is a relatively new new consideration in policing terms, there's plenty of historical anecdotes to show that police forces, as I say, in many countries, have for many, many years, decades, have been involved in supporting public health policies. If you take the example of test purchase operations, which in many countries form the backbone of operational practices designed to arrest and prosecute street dealers, people selling relatively small amounts of drugs on the street. That particular tactic has its origins in the Victorian police in England and indeed in other countries, which really developed tactics around the concerns of public health considerations because of grocers, of storekeepers, shopkeepers selling adulterated milk, selling adulterated medicines, counterfeit medicines. So there's a real strong public health component there in the history of many police forces. And again, those historical facts can actually be exploited when you're talking to counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, and I think what's interesting is that when you think about the origins of the current war on drugs going back sort of 40, 50 years, that was actually driven by a need to preserve and enhance public health, but actually somehow got distorted in the process. And we now see most of the money going into enforcement and very little going into prevention and treatment and the like. Although I want to put in a little bit of a plug for the new United States drug strategy, because even though I think it's politically impossible to tackle what might be termed the enforcement side of the strategy, the real strong pointers towards a coherent approach to prevention and treatment is something that I think really needs to be encouraged. I know the US is often seen as being the big bad people who are driving, the war on drugs, and of course to a large extent that's the case. But I think I see some opportunities for change there. It kind of helps with one of the questions we've just got on the panel from David Patterson, who's from the International Development Law Organization, and he talks about capacity building at, I think we're getting quite a few questions now, which is excellent, thank you. I hope we have time to cover them all. My apologies if we don't. What capacity building is needed at a senior level? What opportunities exist? What's being done? Well, I'm going to come to Dato' Zaman in a moment, because we did some work together in Malaysia, and I'd like you to comment on that. But I'm also, I visited Peru in April, And together with a man called Ricardo Sobon, who runs some people are nodding and know him, we burst into the chief of the Peruvian police's office. We didn't burst in, but you know, I like to dramatize these things. And we said, we've got to have a course for your senior police officers. On the 6th of September, this September, we've got 4 days with about 180 delegates with some international speakers talking about drug policy reform. That's capacity building at that sort of level. It's introducing people to new ideas and concepts. But what it also tells me is that people are receptive. I think many senior police officers have the view, we know what we're doing isn't working, but we don't know what to do differently. So, a little bit, Dr. Zaman, on perhaps on the seminar in December and some things that may have arisen out of that.
Yes, with the background of Jeffrey said earlier about laws and all that, I think the way to tackle them is to educate the police on HIV and the need to for treatment. Years ago, about 5 years ago, when I first joined the Malaysian AIDS Council, I was invited to, as the police chief, they call it the Commanders Conference. And there were about 30 to 40 of them. When I say the war on drugs is lost, one of them stood up, sir, because he was my junior then. You're wrong, he says. How can you give in? He said, I'm not giving in. I'm telling you, we have got to do what he called is damage control. We have to educate the police. I have been going around talking to police officers. In November last year, we organized a seminar. Tom was there, and we were very fortunate at that time to have Alex Wodek around.
Alex Wodek,
and Dr. Shara, free of charge, of course. They happened to be around, and they give a talk. And I'm happy to say, ever since because these people were the middle rank commanders who attended the meeting. They are the ones who sort of give instructions to the subordinate what to do and not to do on the ground. And I'm happy to say that the number of rape and harassment has decreased. Be that as it may, I think we need to do more. Happily, of course, I still have my sort of influence with the police. They have opened the doors. We have been giving talk to the police. We have addressed the police college. We have also given talk, after dinner talk, to a number of police districts on the need for them to be involved in harm reduction. Now, I think it's relevant for me to say, although in Malaysia, we have the Cabinet Committee on Drug, and the Inspector General of Police sits there, and then we have National Task Force on Harm Reduction. Again, there's the Chief of Police sits there. And mind you, in Malaysia, the bill for methadone and for needle exchange for condone, every cent of it comes from the Malaysian government. Yet, in spite of that, we still have harassment by the law enforcement agencies. It's very rare, isn't it? The government supports it, yet the police is not supporting it. But this is due to the lack of education, I think. We have to continue engaging the police and other law enforcement agencies so that they will appreciate the need to do this sort of to be engaged in harm reduction.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you'll resonate with is what I'm about to say, is that there's never enough money to do some of this work. And I've never met a police chief who said, thank you, I have sufficient resources to do my job. And one of the concerns we've got, and there's a question here from Lucy of the UK, which is about how you can ensure that police are equipped with the necessary skills and sensitivity to engage in this kind of harm reduction work. And, you know, the simple answer is, well, if you engage the police chiefs and they want to do it, then you can go further down and start looking at the sort of training that Alex was talking about and those other issues. I mean, the answer to that, but the difficulty is embedding that in existing training programs. And therefore you have to push something else out. But I mean, I just wonder whether you might want to comment on that, because this is about getting stuff really at the street level, whilst it's always important to get to the higher strategic levels. But Alex.
Thank you. We started from to educate our police force I'm still using this, you know, automatically I'm still using this force, this word force, not a service. This is very important to understand what's happened in our part of the world. Still force, police force. So we started to educate them in 1998. And we started from NGO. They came to the scene and they started to educate, just came to the police station and to deliver a class for a dozen police officers. First of all, patrol police officers, traffic police, those who are working on the street directly. And later on, international organization came to us and started to provide a TOT training. So police newspaper, we have to use a police newspaper for that. There are a couple of police newspapers in the country in our national language and Russian language. So for police officer now, it's very difficult to use a central newspaper or to use the internet in very remote area, but they need to read a police newspaper. That's why we started to provide them education via police newspaper. And it was very, very, still till now, it is very, very popular way of education, by the way. So we spent a lot of effort to educate them. And finally, we created a special training course in police academy in our country. And all of the cadets need to pass 48 hours harm reduction course and pass the exam later. They need to. So, and it is for the process to create this special course. We invited not only professors and high-ranked police officers, but also the NGO people, people who are living with HIV, sex workers, and it was first experience when we cooperate together. And later, when we started to provide TOT for police, first time when they came to the police auditory, those people, not as a prisoners, but as a trainers. And it was very interesting to see the police reaction from very, very beginning. But now, after 3 years, we are doing it regularly, and now it is absolutely normal. And if it's possible, a couple of words about legislation.
Yes, sure.
We have to change the legislation. We started this process also 10 years ago. First of all, to depenalize the drug using, and later on, it is a full decriminalization. But later on, a little bit later on, we recognize it is not enough. So that's why, again, up to the police initiative. Police decided it is a time to do it. We started to change, and now, since 2007, we are using the very promoted legislation. For example, we are not sending people behind the bar for the less amount than 1 gram of heroin, 20 grams of marijuana, and 5 grams of raw opium.
And is this something that's driven by the police?
Yeah.
Well, that's an important point, isn't it? It comes back to that point about opportunities within current legislation. There was a question about the amount of drugs in possession which might or might not qualify for dealing. I just quickly answer that by saying in Portugal, where they have run a very successful, well, I don't think it's an experiment now, I think it's reality, since 2001, I think, they decriminalized possession of all drugs, with a limit which I think gives a good flexibility of something like a quantity which amounts to personal use for 10 days. Now, I think that gives a sort of flexibility without having a definite amount. In the UK, we tried to set an amount and couldn't get there. And I think actually the way Portugal have done it is very good because that gives flexibility. There was also a question about human rights. I don't want to dismiss that question, but it's interesting. You know, should there be courses on human rights? I believe that if you want to engage police officers in human rights, don't lecture them about human rights, but give them the tools to be effective and professional. And if you're a professional investigator, you won't feel the need to make up evidence. You will actually be able to convict the right person with the proper evidence for the crime they committed, not the innocent person just to make up the numbers. So it's actually about teaching professionalism as opposed to simply teaching human rights. I mean, I know we could expand on that, but time is limited. I actually want to now broaden it out. And Jeff, I'd like to ask you this. I'm trying to put together some some questions. It's a good one here from, I think, Peris from Norway. And I also combine this with, if I can. Well, let me just, there are too many cards here. I think I'm just, I'll focus on this one. Did you have such enlightened views when you were acting, serving police officers? And if not, why not? Well, okay, I acknowledge the implied criticism there. I think I mentioned it a moment ago. But no, there is a question also from Megan Harris from the USA. We're all in support of harm reduction activities on the panel. Do we think our views mirror the majority? Do they reflect the majority of other police officers' views? So it's something about, you know, maybe a personal question, but also something about, do we think that there really are a substantial number of police officers who want to change, or is there still a huge sort of rump who are resistant? Jeff first, yeah, please.
I think in terms of practicing what I now preach, I think my track record is fairly well documented. The short answer is yes, I was committed to the notion of harm reduction many, many years ago. And even though I didn't particularly think it is terms of harm reduction, I've always tried to take a humanistic approach to policing. I mean, I instigated and was one of the co-authors of the ACPO policy document on case disposal options for drug offenders, and that document is still available, and if anyone wanted to read it, they could see that we promoted the idea of cautioning, not just for possession offences, but also drug trafficking offences, inappropriate circumstances. I was part of a body which looked at how we could support the introduction and implementation of needle syringe programs in the 1980s. And one of the things we did was, at that time, there was a heavy reliance, inappropriate reliance, we would say now, but a real reliance commitment to the idea of exchange one for one. And of course, arrestees would often be detained in police stations, and the police, quite rightly, would seize, use syringes, sterile syringes, and more likely than not return them to the person when released from police custody. So this meant that they would then have to try and negotiate replacement syringes with the local program and justify why it was that they weren't able to return 12 syringes and collect replacement syringes. And we came up with the notion that we'd simply issue them, if you remember, Form 613, PPV, a property receipt.
Bureaucracy in action.
That they could actually just go along and present the police form, which was signed with a contact number, and say, you know, Bill Smith was had 10 syringes taken from him yesterday, and that's it. So it's just simple responses like this, which was, which really helped. As I say, the implementation.
I think it's fair to say there were people like Jeff and others who were driving change, because Jeff was in a position where he was advising the ACPO is the Chief Police Officers Organisation in the UK. So you're in a position. I think I'm sure you got yourself in that position deliberately to influence things. I just wondered, Datuk, from the Malaysian perspective, whether you think there are really quite a number of senior police officers who actually think there really should be change and they just feel constrained because they're in office.
Well, during my time, I don't smell that. But I think lately there are a number of officers who are quite supportive of what we do. For example, the chief of one state, Terengganu, we wanted to introduce an SCP in the area. I went to see him, of course, to get police operation. But he offered me a lot of advice. He was my junior before, but he's up there now. Mm-hmm. He offered me a lot of advice. And I think that to me is an indication of his support to action on that.
Alex, I was wondering for you, was there a blinding flash when you suddenly realised that everything you'd been doing as a police officer was wrong, or did it come about gradually? In my case, it was a sort of a gradual realization that what I was doing wasn't helping. In fact, it was harming. What about your case?
Yeah, my case. You know, during my police career, I've seen behind the bar thousands of people, especially for marijuana cases. So now, since something like beginning of 1980s, I started we are doing wrong. It is impossible to send such a huge amount of people behind the bar for the grass. It is absolutely impossible. So, but we continue to do it because of the law, because of the situation in such a particular time. But we started to understand, more or less, it is not a right way. So, later on, after the independent time, when the international organization came to the scene, they started to educate us, and I was the first wave, let me say, of educated police officer in this issue, in human rights, first of all, and secondly, in harm reduction.
How many of your colleagues do you think kind of listen to the message and change their views as you've done?
You know what, it's interesting, but the new generation of police officers, they already recognize it, and they understood us. We are talking in the same language.
Right.
With the old generation of police, it is a little bit difficult, but for them, we especially created a special instruction up to the order of the minister how it's necessary to cooperate with a vulnerable group of people. And this instruction you must follow. So it is a second way of police education.
I think, Tom, it's a question of exposure. For example, a number of officers who are in support have been to a number to conference like in Bangkok, in Melbourne, all that. Now these people, I think exposure is very important. To bring them to a conference like this is a window to the world.
Okay, so if there's a conference organizer in the room, and I know there are some, that's a clear message. When you hold your next conference, make sure that you invite some senior police officers from around the world.
Because fortunately, we provide it for them to attend. This is the most effective.
Yeah, and then give them the opportunity to engage. And sometimes you get away from if you're sitting in your office, you know, with your uniform on, it's a difficult environment in which to explore and experiment. Thank you, by the way, very much for all these questions coming. I think the answer to that question was we had been doing a few things when we were in office, but police are constrained, and so there is a message there about helping the police to operate. And I think there's something about helping the police to do what they do, which is things like fight crime, but do it in such a way that in fighting crime, you might actually be helping somebody who's committing crime, say, to fund their drugs habit. You might be offering them alternatives to prison and offering treatment as opposed to punishment as a means of both lowering crime that they're committing, but also helping them to get their life back in order. There's an interesting question here, and it's about if somebody who knows they have HIV does not disclose this and infects someone with HIV, is this a crime? I think we have a case of somebody being convicted for that in the UK fairly recently. So in the UK, certainly a crime.
And is it a crime to have HIV?
This is somebody deliberately infecting somebody with HIV.
Is in our law?
It is as well.
Is in our law, but nobody has been charged with that.
I don't know who asked that question, but if you have done that, then you are guilty of an offence. I'm sorry. Some people get used to my sense of humour eventually. Now, Sonia from the UNODC in Thailand, your question is, you know, if the war on drugs policy is so harmful, how does that, you know, on what grounds, what's the justification for that fueling the detention of drug users, denial of universal rights, etc.? Well, I think the answer to that is really why we're here. I mean, that is the big question, that increasingly, I think the grounds for that aren't there, and that's really the core of the issue that we're dealing with. There's a question here which you might be able to help with, and I'm not sure, but probably you, Datuk Zaman. It's about HIV programs for prisoners.
Yeah.
HIV programs for prisoners.
Yeah.
What sort of opportunities are there to support people in prison? I know that it's a very contentious subject, and you may have some comments on the UK perspective, but perhaps from your perspective first.
When I first went to the prison, HIV then was quite new to Malaysia. It first appeared in 1986. By the time, with the little knowledge that we have, there are a lot of don'ts. For example, we don't, because of the stigma, we isolate the HIV, people living with HIV in special block among themselves and all that. Again, we were told that was wrong and all that. But we did that also to prevent a sort of infection, because, things happen in the prison cell. But now, we have proper treatment for them. ART, if you are on ART, you have been given ART. Again, it's been given free by the government. And you're also exposed to counseling and all that. And if you are still an HIV, if you are still on drug, you are advised to go to methadone, because we provide methadone in the prison. And then if you go out, you will continue to get that treatment, but you'll be given a card to go to where you want to go and see the medical officer or the health clinic to get that treatment. So in fact, there is, earlier on, I must admit, when I went there, there's not much of attention given to these people on the isolation and all that. But it is because of the isolation that I'm influenced. I became converted. One day I passed by a block. I heard prayers. About 30 to 40 of them were different religions, you know, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims and all that. Each were praying. I don't know whatever they prayed for. Then I knew that I had to help them.
Jeff, just quickly, is there some good practice about, you know, dealing with people who are suffering with HIV/AIDS in prisons?
Yeah, very much so. I'm proud of the fact that UNODC has been highly instrumental in driving that good practice, identifying the good practice, promoting the good practice, but more importantly, funding the good practice. And there's a number of documents which I'm sure most of you know, published by UNODC, often in collaboration with other UN co-sponsors. Perhaps I should mention at this stage too that, in fact, we have one of our consultants in the audience, Professor Diane Riley from Canada. Diane was one of the founders of the International Harm Reduction Association. And we've been very busy working on producing a training manual for law enforcement agencies with a focus on prison services and police services. And we're hoping that will also enable NGOs, partners to engage with the police more readily in, as I say, promoting HIV prevention policies, those policies which really work, those policies which really do make an impact on HIV, hepatitis.
We're running out of time. I wanted Alex to comment on the same thing about, from your experience, is there any good practice in relation to treating people with HIV in prison?
Okay. Taking into consideration the limited of time, just a couple of practical advice. So we are doing in Kyrgyzstan, we are doing first of all in methadone treatment into the prison, and something like eight years already we deliver, and we are doing the syringe and needles exchange in the prison, and together with our international partners and local NGOs, we are doing a couple of very interesting programs like Atlantis. And last year, the clean zone were opened in Kyrgyzstan. So hundreds of imprisoned from all of the prison system went to this prison, who already passed the Atlantis, and they are doing now just some psychologist testing, like a rehabilitation center. We have to use this zone, clean zone, as a rehabilitation center. So it is very well doing in Kyrgyzstan, these programs.
Well, that's encouraging. In the UK, I think in the last 2 years ago, some prisoners successfully took the prison authorities to court because they were methadone users. And when they went to prison, they weren't supplied with any methadone. And there was public outcry, as you might imagine, in a place like the UK, which is really quite a punitive society, that these people could get their methadone in prison. But at least the law was standing up on their side, and so their treatment could continue. Now, we're closing in on time. I think it's much more important that I spend less time summing up and more time answering what is actually really a very good question. Sorry, all the questions are good, but this one just struck a chord. It's in countries where the police practice torture, perhaps with impunity, how do NGOs and others, United Nations, international organizations, local people, how do you engage and discuss with the police a way of doing things differently? It's perhaps much easier in certain countries to engage with the police than in others. And I think that's a really good question, because in some cases it's very, very tough. And this gap, I'm not suggesting that the gap isn't real and the lack of trust between the police and other people isn't real. But I am saying we need to bridge it, and this question gets to the heart of it in the most difficult places. If a panelist would like to start to answer that question, not necessarily with an answer, but at least offer some thoughts.
Well, I would be great to say if I deny that there is sort of a rough tactic in use on suspect. But I think... speaking for my country, I think of late, I would advise my police officers don't ever do it, because of the legal people, access to legal, legal people in my country is quite easy, I think, and in fact they have sort of a legal aid bureau and all that. And because of that, I think there is not much heard of sort of strong objective being used now. And especially, and the police too, I think, moving forward in some interrogation room. I think they are beginning to have CCTV and all that now. And of course we have that incident, not the police.
I mean, the work currently being done in Mexico, the big word there is trying to develop accountability. And Mexico certainly is a country.
We don't have that sort of thing.
Accountability is perhaps a way forward. Jeff, some very quick thoughts, and then Alex.
Again, I'm pleased to say that UNODC, first of all, takes this matter very seriously indeed. And we really do have a professional, I would argue, a legal obligation to challenge countries and systems which obviously engage in this practice. My colleague Mikhail Golchenko from the Russian office, a lawyer, has been busy over the last 2 years helping NGOs in Russia to understand the legal mechanisms at their disposal so that they can actually bring cases before the national courts, and if they don't get satisfaction there, to go on to the international court. So that's a very important thing for UNODC to be involved with. And I would urge all of you to really exploit the legal systems in place and to really push for cases to go to court and to engage Sasha's a journalist, so he will know the value of this, to try and get journalists to support you in your efforts.
Yes.
Okay. We have to use a different approach, and it is a still big problem for us as a police torture. So the last our decision, we on the frame of the very well known American Millennium Challenge program, we organized a special civilian control unit. And we selected people, the society selected, they were elected actually for this union, and especially a representative of vulnerable group became the members of this group, of this unit, and now they are receiving complaints from the citizens, and they are doing their own investigation, so they are controlling police now. It's working already.
So that sounds that even though things may be difficult, things can actually change for the better if you're sufficiently determined. Now, Last question is from Khalid. Why does law enforcement act against the harm reduction programs, and how can we convince them otherwise? Well, I think that's what today was about. How can we do that? I think I have a minute. I have now the opportunity to sum up, but I'll do it as quickly as I can. We're here because we want police and other law enforcement agencies to change the way they do things so that harm is reduced and human rights are respected. How does that come about? Well, we've heard about education. We've heard about changing objectives so that objectives of reducing crime and disorder align with objectives to promote health and to reduce harm. And those should be joint objectives, shared, so the cooperation partnership becomes the way that the police operate. There's no way that this issue can be addressed either by health agencies on their own or police on their own. The two have to work together, because we've seen how closely police action can impact negatively on health, and also there are examples where it can impact positively on health outcomes. Discretion is possible. The police cannot rely on the fact that the law says we have to do this and we have to do that. Even in those states which appear to be very tightly controlled, there are opportunities for discretion. And if you have all of that happening, and people like me get the funding to work with others so that at the senior level people are increasingly given opportunities to understand there are different ways of doing things, we really do believe that there's the opportunity to change. And just sort of looking at the environment we're in at the moment, when Bill Clinton is saying the harm reduction is the answer, he knows it works. The UNODC is increasingly publishing documents that talk about prevention and treatment. The new US drug strategy. I think if you look about, there really are some signs, and certainly I get those signs, that we've really got to be pushing harder and harder. So, my thanks to the organisers for the opportunity for us to address this topic. As I said, perhaps surprising, it was at an AIDS conference. I think that the links are very clear. My thanks to you as an audience for participating so well. I'm sorry if I didn't cover all of the questions, but I hope that you've certainly made my job easy in terms of coming up with such good questions which have exercised the panellists. I hope, whilst we haven't solved all the problems, we've given you an insight into the sort of work that's going on. If you're interested in finding out more about it, I assume the programme lets you know who we are, and so don't hesitate to get in touch. The other thing is that at 6:15 today, we'll be holding another session for an hour with opportunities, for interaction, largely on the same topic, and this will be in the drug policy networking zone of the Global Village. If you go in the main entrance and you turn left, it's in the corner. That's from 6:15 for an hour, so we'd really like to see, I'm not sure we'll see all of you there. Again, but if either you want to come back or you know somebody else who might be interested, do mention it to them. We look forward to seeing you then. In the meantime, it remains for me just to thank the panellists. Well done, all three of you. Thank you very much. And our audience. Thank you very much indeed. Goodbye.